This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Happy New Year. This week, we've been listening back to some of our memorable interviews from 2009. Today, we feature our conversation with actor Ted Danson, recorded in September. In case you haven't noticed, he's been doing some really interesting work on television lately, playing characters very different from the shallow and vain bartender Sam Malone on the sitcom Cheers. On the FX series Damages, he's played a corrupt billionaire CEO. On Larry David's HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm, Ted Danson and his wife Mary Steenburgen play versions of themselves, friends of Larry David. And Danson co-stars in the series Bored to Death, which just concluded its first season on HBO. It was created by writer Jonathan Ames. The series stars Jason Schwartzman as a writer named Jonathan Ames, who's stuck. He's not getting anywhere with his writing, and his girlfriend has just walked out on him, accusing him of drinking too much and smoking too much marijuana. So he tries to emulate the life of the hard-boiled detectives in his favorite novels. He puts an ad on Craigslist offering his services as an unlicensed private detective, and he starts getting responses. Ted Danson plays his boss, a powerful magazine editor named George Christopher. In this scene from the first episode, they're at a gallery opening, when George asks Jonathan if he has any pot. He does, and so they go into the men's room. George is surprised to see that Jonathan is carrying his marijuana in a prescription pill bottle.
This is my Viagra bottle. What are you doing with marijuana in my Viagra bottle?
You gave me that bottle months ago. There were two pills left in it. You told me I should try them. Now I'm putting my pot in
there. Are you insane? What if you got arrested for marijuana possession? Page 6 would have a field day. I can't have... Hello? Hello? I can't have the world knowing that I use Viagra.
Do you really need to take so much?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. My heart medicine and heavy drinking have taken a toll. I'm not what I once was. But I accept that. It's called humility.
Why are you back on pot?
Because I'm bored. God, I'm bored. Death by a thousand dull conversations. I don't know what's going on, but almost everybody has bad wine breath tonight. It's like Chernobyl out there.
Do you think we drink too much?
No, we don't drink too much. Men face reality, women don't. That's why men need to drink.
That's a line from my novel.
Yeah, well, you stole it from me.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, actually, you did.
Actually, no, I didn't.
Fine, Jonathan.
Anyway, Suzanne moved out today because she says I drink too much.
Well, I'm not surprised.
Why do you say that?
Because you're like me, Jonathan. We enthrall and then we disappoint.
Ted Danson, welcome to Fresh Air.
That's a great line. I love that.
Yeah, that's a great, it's a great line.
We enthrall and then we disappoint.
Yeah. Jonathan Ames created this series, Bored to Death. What did he tell you about who he based your character on?
I don't know that he said that he based it on anyone specific. It was a very small character in the beginning. And then when I came on board and they decided to make it bigger, for me, I kind of drew on my father's day, if not directly my father, that old world gentleman, you know, very bright, well-spoken, kind of old world style person who always wears a tie.
It's funny that you say you wanted to base the character on your father's kind of old school ways, old world ways.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a character who, like, smokes marijuana and, you know, drinks too much. And I mean, that's, your father wouldn't have been doing that, I don't think.
No. No. But no, he wasn't. But, you know, there's the one side of him that is, he's very bright, very intelligent. He's the editor and publisher of a, you know, well-respected magazine. He rubs shoulders with, you know, very intelligent, bright, literary people in New York. So he can play that game. And then there's part of him that hasn't quite grown up and has had too many marriages, too many parties. And what he really wants in life is to not be left out by youth. Let me do whatever Jason Schwartzman's character is doing. Let me please don't leave me out. Are you smoking marijuana? Then I want some. Are you having a colonic? Oh, I want a colonic. You know, it's whatever Jason is doing. Please don't leave me out. I want to still be excited by life. So take me with you.
You're getting to play much more varied characters than you did when you were younger and famous originally. Because mm-hmm. people got so used to you as Sam Malone, the bartender on Cheers, who was the opposite of intellectual. And the power that he had was like the power in the bar. But now you're playing people who have like, you know, real power, who are kind of successful and also often like self-delusional. And sometimes yes, with a little bit of an evil streak. And it's been really fun for me as a viewer to discover that side of you as an actor.
Fun for me, too. I have to admit, I think part of me thought I had stayed at the half-hour comedy dance a bit too long. And I think part of me was going, wow, I'm not as funny as these other people who are coming up. And I was kind of boring myself in a way. And then Damages came along and really kind of turned things around for me.
Well, you mentioned Damages, so there's a perfect opportunity to play a scene from it. And Damages is an FX series starring Glenn Close as a lawyer. And in this, you play Arthur Frobisher, a billionaire CEO who cashed in his stocks, and then the company went under, leaving the employees without jobs or pensions. So they hired a lawyer, the Glenn Close character, to file a class action suit against you. You really want to save your reputation. So one of the things you've done is get a writer to write a book about you. But the writer has his own idea. And, you know, he wants to do some investigation, find out who you really are, what you've really done right. in your life, some of the bad things you've done in your life. You see this book as an opportunity to just, like, burnish your reputation and talk about, you know, like, your ladder to success and overcoming the odds. So right. You show up very inappropriately at midnight, unannounced, at the writer's house.
And slightly drunk.
With a whole box of like your trophies and your ribbons and memorabilia that's designed to show him what each of these things represent in your life and what you had to go through to achieve the success that each of these objects represent. So here's the scene.
No, see, look, this stuff, all this is my integrity. See what I'm saying? Here, look. Third prize, middle school spelling bee.
Great.
No, I'm dyslexic. Remember I told you that? So that's determination. Here, look. Yeah, all right, varsity. This is interesting. Varsity, that's the first time I realized that I was a natural leader.
Yeah, you know, all this stuff that you're giving me is great. Yeah. But this book...
All right, look. All right, here, come here. This shirt, right? Shirt you're wearing, you own other shirts, right? So if I come along and say, you know, define you as the guy who wears this shirt, I'd be wrong, right? Because you're not just one thing. See, that's what I'm trying to say. You're not just one thing. Hey, I told you, right, that I started off dirt poor.
You told me yesterday about that.
Well, why don't you write? See, all right, hey, listen. 17, I came this close to joining the army. Realize that.
Mr. Frobisher, I haven't seen Indira for 2 weeks. She has been traveling, understand, and this is our night together. So we'll just cut it short.
Wait, all right, let's back up here. Tell me about your book.
My novel?
Sorry, your novel.
It's hard to describe.
Just tell me what it's about.
On the face of it, it's a love story. It's about nostalgia and how that affects our core relationships.
Jesus, George. I mean, that sounds like crap. Are you kidding me? Look what you're doing here. I mean, you're sleeping on a futon. Come on. I mean, you know, of course you're writing about my life. You don't have one, you know? And you're immigrant because what?
Excuse
you
know, me?
You appreciate their
Excuse
culture.
Excuse me?
Is that what you're saying to yourself? Truth is, you're just trying to feel superior. Try running a $40 billion industry. See how that makes you feel.
Get out.
Yeah, try managing 11,000 employees.
Just leave.
You want to know why they're suing me, you invisible piece of? Because I'm worth it.
I hope that you lose everything.
Yeah, you be careful.
Because you are an arrogant...
Hey, guess what? You're fired.
And that punch was the sound of the Ted Danson character hitting the ghostwriter really hard, maybe breaking his nose. That's such a great scene.
With my little toy car.
That's right. I love the way you play that scene. There's a lot of words that you only like half say. It's almost like it's partly because you're drunk, but it's partly because like time is, you're so important and you have so little time, you don't even have to say the whole word, you know?
Cause
you've said that you worked with an acting coach before doing Damages. And I guess I'm wondering why you've acted for decades. Why did you feel the need to do that?
I did work with an acting coach right beforehand. His name's Harold Guskin, and he's worked with a lot of people. Glenn Close actually has worked with him. James Gandolfini and the producers, Glenn and the writers, Glenn and Todd Kessler knew him for years and actually pulled me aside about 2 days before we started shooting the pilot and said, we'd love you to go see our acting coach. And it was like, uh-oh. You know, they hate my work. They want me to do something that they don't think I'm capable of. But it was fantastic because what he told me was, we just talked, you know, read the scene once and kind of talked about it. And what he said to me was actually kind of exciting for me just as an actor, because I had been doing comedy half hour for so long, which has this rhythm to it. It's almost like doing a musical. There is a rhythm you need to adhere to. It was very nice to come and do this drama. And what he said to me was, you know, don't, you have four lines you're about to do. You have a paragraph in the script. Well, maybe you're going to say one line. Maybe you'll say two. Maybe you won't feel like saying the other lines, and maybe you won't. You're Arthur Frobisher. You'll do what you want when you want. And if you don't feel like, you know, you don't be the nice actor. Don't give them what they want. Do whatever you want. And he instilled this kind of creative arrogance in me that was the same arrogance of the character, the billionaire who doesn't really have to answer to anyone and can do whatever he wants because people love him because he's a billionaire.
Ted Danson speaking to Terry Gross last September. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview recorded in September with actor Ted Danson, whose TV career was launched with the hit sitcom Cheers.
On HBO and the Larry David series, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you've played yourself, Ted Danson. And your wife, Mary Steenburgen, plays your wife and plays herself. So when you started on Curb Your Enthusiasm, how did you figure out who the Curb version of Ted Danson was going to be?
You know, it's probably the same way that I figure out all parts. I'm very bad at doing homework. I can't look at a suit on a rack and go, oh, I'd like that suit. I have to try it on. So I try on words. I read the board. If it's a well thought out, very creative writer, you know, that you respect, then you try on the words and you go, you know, when I say these words, it makes me feel this way, or I feel like doing this. I think it's the same thing. Even though you're playing yourself, you go, all right, what is my function here? My function is to be a foil for Larry David. My function is to set up roadblocks or do something that heighten what he's really funny at, you know, funny at. So it becomes, you shape yourself, even though your name's Ted Danson and you're married to Mary Steenburgen. But the truth is you are trying to do what's best in each scene to highlight Larry, which is why I hate Larry. I don't really like him. I'm tired of highlighting Larry. I'm glad you laugh because he's one of our best friends and we, you know, see him all the time socially, and he's lived in our guest house for 2 summers in a row. Mary calls him Larry the Lodger. He just won't leave.
So is this why you're in the series? Because you're already friends?
Yeah, I probably.
So are there scenes in episodes of Curb that actually came out of your life or came out of your real relationship with Larry David?
Not necessarily, although when you go out to dinner with him, it's way scarier than acting with him because he's always pulling out his notebook, or you don't know whether or not he's doing a scene in a restaurant and being a little louder than he should be because he's practicing something for next week, or whether this is truly Larry. It's a very scary kind of proposition, hanging out with Larry David.
I can imagine it would be a little embarrassing when he's talking too loud or doing something inappropriate, and you don't know whether he's testing a performance or just being weird.
We've sat in a restaurant, a very sweet, quiet inn, you know, New England inn, with a lot of people with kind of blue-gray hair, and he came in late, and his back was to the entire restaurant, but we were looking at the entire restaurant over his shoulder, and he was whispering this story in a kind of stage whisper that had the F word in it a lot, and he basically cleared the restaurant. And then as he's walking out, he went, "Nice restaurant. A little too quiet for a Jew, but it's a nice restaurant," and walked out. And it was like, and you kind of have to walk in his wake going, "Sorry, sorry, sorry. You know it's Larry. Sorry."
That sounds so much like it should be on Curb. And maybe
it
will
is.
Be.
Yeah, and will be, right.
I want to play a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm. This is an episode in which you and your wife, Mary Steenburgen, have invited Larry David and his wife to a party. And he doesn't like parties. He doesn't want to go. So he comes.
This is real.
This is totally real.
Great,
great.
This summer, he would not go to people's homes for dinner. I'll go to a restaurant because then I can leave when I want. But at a home, I'm stuck. I don't want to come. And he made this a rule of thumb. Anyway, please go on.
Okay, okay. So in this scene, he doesn't want to go to your party, so he comes up with this scheme that he'll pretend that he thought your party was really the next day. So the day after the party, he shows up at your door and, you know, saying, "Oh, okay, we're here for the party." And he expects that you'll say, "Oh, it was last night," and then he could just go home. But that's not what happens. So here's the scene.
Hey!
Hey!
What you guys doing? What's going on?
What do you mean?
Where is everybody?
We thought there was a party.
Oh, my God. You thought the party was tonight?
Yeah.
Last night. The party was last night.
Are you kidding me?
No, man.
That's unbelievable. What? We got the wrong night?
Yeah, you did.
Jesus Christ. Holy cow.
I was actually glad to hear this. I was a little pissed off that you didn't call.
Well, now you know why we didn't call.
Hey, Mary.
Of course we didn't call, because we're coming tonight.
Come on in.
No,
we're not going to come in.
Yeah, come in.
No.
We got the wrong night. It's our fault.
It doesn't matter.
Hey, Mary, we're
right. The party is tonight.
So stupid. You're kidding.
Can you believe how stupid we are?
All right, it's good to see you guys. We'll call you later.
No way you're leaving. This is fantastic. We have so much leftover food. You're going to come in and help us eat it.
You know what? I'll call you tomorrow.
Yes.
We'll get together. We'll do the whole thing.
We'll
take you out to dinner. I'm paying.
Hey, Larry, you don't have any plans. You're supposed to be here. You're here. Come on in. Come on, Cheryl. Be fun. Come on in. This should be fun. Hey, we got leftovers. Make an omelet or something. Come on.
Sure.
Guys,
oh, yeah.
We can.
That'd
be great. Come on.
This is like pulling teeth. Come on in, you guys.
That's a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm, with my guest Ted Danson. So let's look at the scene that we just heard.
Okay.
Did you get a script for that scene? Did Larry David tell you what it was about and then ask you to just improv your lines? How did it work?
Yeah, that's something everybody should know about Larry David. He's the laziest writer on the planet. You know, if he ever wins a writing award, I'll pick it. I'm semi-joking. What he does is he works for months on setting up the season, the arc of the season. Then each show is broken down into scenes, and this is pretty typical of a writing room for comedies. You break everything down beat by beat so that the last thing you do is you send a writer off to write the actual dialogue. He takes it right up to the dialogue part, so it's very intricate. It's been worked out. You know what he needs, but the words that come out of your mouth have not been written.
Now, you got your start on the TV series Cheers, which is one of the more famous TV series in TV history. How did you get the audition for that?
You know, I think several things I heard later, you know, came out later. Jimmy Burrows, who, along with Glenn and Les Charles, created Cheers. He was the director. They were the two writers. And they had been teamed up for a few years. And I had auditioned for Jimmy Burrows maybe a year or two beforehand for a show that I did not get. And he remembered me. And then when we actually auditioned for it in front of the network and everything, they had three actors and three actresses to play Sam and Diane, and they had a little stage set up, and it was this little act-off, you know, where each couple would come out and do a scene and then leave, then the other couple would come out, and that's, I think I got the part because Shelley and I were good together. Shelley was remarkable, and I think I got the part because Shelley was so good and I worked well with Shelley, to be honest. I think that's how that happened.
Ted Danson speaking to Terry Gross in September. More about the TV show Cheers and our interview with Ted Danson in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Sometimes you wanna go where everybody... This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're back with Ted Danson. He co-stars in the HBO series Bored to Death. He plays himself on Larry David's HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. And on the FX series Damages, he's played a corrupt billionaire CEO. Terry Gross spoke with him in September. When we left off, they were talking about Danson's work on the TV series Cheers, in which he played the shallow and vain bartender Sam Malone.
Did you feel like you knew this character?
No, Lord, no. I didn't. I had no idea how unintelligent he was. At first, I thought he was making these, because Sam would come out with these things that were funny, and I thought, well, maybe he's being ironic. You know, maybe he's smart enough to know that he's saying stupid things in the beginning. I think it took me about a year and a half before, maybe a season and a half, before I had an inkling on how to play Sam Malone, because he was a relief pitcher, which comes with a certain amount of arrogance. You know, you only get called in when you're in trouble and you're there to save the day. And that takes a special kind of arrogance, I think. And Sam Malone had that arrogance, and I, Ted Danson, did not. I was nervous, scared, excited about, you know, grateful about my new job.
Well, let's hear a scene from season one, and we'll hear the kind of arrogance that you're talking about that your character...
Or lack of.
Or yeah. Lack of that your character, Sam Malone, had. So here's a scene with you and Shelley Long.
Why are you so upset?
You know, this week I have gone out with all the women I know. I mean, all the women I really enjoyed. And all of a sudden, all I can think about is how stupid they are. I mean, my life isn't fun anymore. And it's because of you.
Because of me?
Yeah. You're a snob.
A snob?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you're a rapidly aging adolescent.
Well, I would rather be that than a snob.
And I would rather be a snob.
Well, good, because you are.
Sam, do yourself a favor. Go back to your Tootsies and your rat parts. I'd hate to see the bowling alleys close on my account.
Hey, wait a minute. Are you saying that I'm too dumb to date smart women?
I'm saying that it would be very difficult for you. A really intelligent woman would see your line of BS a mile away.
You think so, huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, you know, I've never met an intelligent woman that I'd want to date.
On behalf of the intelligent women around the world, may I just say,
whew. It's Ted Danson and Shelley Long. So Ted Danson, was that before you felt like you could pull off the arrogance of your character?
Yeah, actually it was. I can actually hear it in my voice, you know. I really, you know, I want to sing Shelley Long's praises. I think the first couple of years, Cheers became the hit that it was because I mean, everyone was good in it, and everyone went on to become brilliant in it. But I think Shelley and that character hadn't been seen for a while on TV, and I think she just did an absolute brilliant, brilliant job.
You know, I remember when I, in one of my interviews with the late actor Spalding Gray, he said he always had trouble acting on TV because he's so interior and always so caught up in his thoughts. So whenever he was on TV, he said he'd look like really worried and preoccupied, and that you needed the certain kind of like Zen TV face. And I'm wondering, you know, I mean, you went to Stanford, you went to prep school, you're obviously like very well educated. Was it hard to get that kind of blankness or that lack of introspection that Sam had?
I think it was Kelsey Grammer has had this great phrase. It probably has been said before, but I heard it from him, that an actor needs a requisite disrespect for the material. Instead of holding it up as the Holy Grail, you know, you need to have a kind of requisite disrespect for it, because then you're not too eager, you're not too leaning forward. And when I first started Cheers, I think I was very eager, and if this makes any sense, I was tilting too far forward. And it took me that year and a half, that season and a half, to get that more relaxed, leaning back, slightly arrogant, you know, let people vote. Who cares? Here I am. I'm going to have fun.
Was it hard to create a new life after Cheers?
Well, I had this great solution. I blew my private life up in such a, you know, disastrous way that leaving Cheers became secondary to kind of putting my private life back together. So to answer your question, not really. I mean, it was hard because I missed my friends. But after 11 years, I think we all had been looking for an ending.
And let me just say, I think what you were alluding to before when you said that after Cheers, your life became public in a big way. I think you're referring to the relationship with Whoopi Goldberg and the whole Friars Club thing, where there was a roast of Whoopi Goldberg, and you worked out a sketch with her in which you appeared in blackface. And, like, boy, they were just like movie stars and politicians and columnists who were so upset and publicly spoke out against you for having done that. It must have been a horrible, a horrible moment.
It was, but I mean, it was of my making, so, you know, it was all on my head. It was definitely a graceless moment in my life. But I kept thinking, well, I have to go roast Whoopi Goldberg. We were no longer actually going together at that moment, and we had tried to back out of, you know, of doing this, and they said, no, you have to, contractually, you have to. And I thought, well, how am I going to roast Whoopi when all the tapes and videos I see of people, a Jewish person will be saying horrible things about the Jewish person they're roasting, but it's okay because the Jewish person being roasted is being roasted by Jewish people. Or, you know, the African-American is being roasted by an African-American. So how's, you know, the white kid going to be roasting and doing, an outrageous job for this amazingly outrageous woman? So I thought, I know, I'm not a stand-up comic, but I am an actor. So I'll do a little performance theater. So that was my rationale. And it was clearly a non-press event, we were told. And within seconds, I realized, oh, wow. It was like sticking my finger in a light socket. I was like, it went very still in my head. And I went, okay, 50% of the people get this and think it's funny. By the way, Whoopi knew about it and had kind of signed off on it and thought it was funny. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go for it. 50% got it, liked it. 30% got it, hated it. 20% didn't get it and hated it. So it was this very, you know, graceless and courageous moment of, okay, here I go. And it did offend some people. And sometimes, I'd have to say rightfully so. Other times, it was theater and it was done with love.
Do you feel like you walked away learning anything either about comedy or about race in America from that experience?
Well, yeah, the stupidity on my part, the lack of thought to stand up and go, I'm now going to do race material and think that it would not draw a lot of heat was stupid on my part. So what did I learn? You know, I learned that I was at a very adolescent point in my life where I thought, you know what? I can do whatever I want. It's okay. You know, I did naively think, because I was told that there would be no press. So I thought, okay, this is a room full of people who get this kind of humor. I'll be all right. And that was stupid on my part. Everything is open to the press now.
You know, what I found really interesting about what you just said? You were saying that, you know, that you think you were arrogant then. And you were telling us before that you didn't know how to be arrogant. Like you didn't have that arrogance, and you had to learn it to play Sam on Cheers. And you were telling us about the kind of arrogance that you needed to have for the part that you play on Damages. This is like billionaire CEO who's like very arrogant. And it's interesting, you're talking about this moment in your life where you were arrogant for real, you think, and you got really burned.
Yeah. You know, actually, what followed, a week later, I had a replay, because evidently I hadn't learned my lesson, where I was driving in a car up a hill, and it was rainy, and I was late, and it was driving a little faster than I should, and I could feel my tires start to skid a little bit, and I almost had this literal thought, maybe not quite, but it was like, Ted, you better slow down. The roads are wet. And I went, no, I'm all right. I can handle this. And I spun out and got hit by a pickup coming the other way and slammed into the side of the cliff. Luckily, didn't go off the other end, you know, the other side, which was a cliff. And I was taken out of my car on a board, and it was all very dramatic. And I was fine. The next day, I had a stiff neck, and that was it. But it was, and that was like the moment where I went, whew, wake up.
So what did you do after that, like, wake up moment? What did you change?
Then it was kind of personal, so I won't go into that.
No, it's fine.
It was ending things that I should have ended. It was, I really did actually take care of business. And about a month later, I met Mary, and I don't think that I would have even seen her, or she would have even seen me, if I hadn't, you know, woken up.
Well, Ted Danson, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ted Danson speaking to Terry Gross in September. His HBO series, Bored to Death, just ended its first season. This is Fresh Air. We're concluding our series of memorable programs from 2009 with an excerpt from our concert celebrating the centennial of the birth of songwriter Johnny Mercer, featuring singer Rebecca Kilgore and pianist, singer, and songwriter Dave Frischberg. Johnny Mercer wrote some melodies, but mostly he wrote lyrics, lots of them, for a body of work that totaled over 1,000 songs, including Blues in the Night, Come Rain or Come Shine, One for My Baby, Skylark, You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby, Jeepers Creepers, The Days of Wine and Roses, and Moon River. Mercer also was a professional singer and the co-founder of Capitol Records. Let's start with a song that was written in 1934 but became really popular during World War II. The music is by Gordon Jenkins. The lyric is by Johnny Mercer. This is P.S. I Love You.
What is there to write? What is there to say? Same things happen every day. Not a thing to write, not a thing to say. So I take my pen in hand and start the same old way. Dear, I thought I'd drop a line. The weather's cool, the folks are fine. I'm in bed each night at 9. P.S. I love you. Yesterday we had some rain, but all in all, can't complain. Was it dusty on the train? P.S. I love you. Write to the Browns just as soon as you're able. They came around to call. I burned a hole in the dining room table. And let me see, I guess that's all. Nothing more for me to say, and so I'll close. But by the way, everybody's thinking of you. P.S. I love you.
Oh, that was really beautiful. You know, I never heard the verse before. Did you find it from sheet music? Or have
oh,
you
yes.
heard other people sing it?
I had never heard anyone sing it.
Lovely. I'm glad you added the verse. That was singer Becky Kilgore with composer, singer, and pianist Dave Frischberg at the piano. And they're doing a centenary tribute to the great lyricist Johnny Mercer. Dave, you actually met Johnny Mercer. How did you meet him?
Well, I met him through my friend Blossom Deary. I was living in New York at the time, and Blossom called me one night. She says, I'm playing at the Village Gate, the top of the gate, and Johnny Mercer's coming to see me, and I want him to meet you, and I want you to meet him. Come over. So I did. I went over to the top of the gate, and I sat at their table.
What happened? Did you get to talk with him?
Oh, a little bit, but we listened pretty carefully while Blossom was on. But the part, I'll always remember this part. When Blossom got off, she joined us at the table, and the other band got on. And the other band was a group of Indian musicians who were playing tablas, and they were playing ragas, they were playing sitars, stuff like that. And they were just wailing away. And we were sitting at a table pretty close by, and we couldn't talk easily. And Mercer was getting very upset, and finally he turned around and he yelled at the band. He said, hey, don't you guys know about swing? 1, 2, 3, 4?
not getting the music at all.
Right. And I thought to myself, wow, that's perfect. That's like a James Thurber cartoon right there, you know.
You also have a story about Mercer where you met him and you took him to hear another singer. Would you tell that one?
Oh, well, I was working at Eddie Condon's at the time when it was at the Sutton Hotel on 56th and 1st Avenue. This was after Mercer had met me at the Village Gate. He came in, I told him I was playing there, and he was interested too. That's his game. He went to Condon's. Afterwards, when the gig was over, he said, take me to hear some good singers. I said, okay. I was thrilled to have him along, even though he was half in the bag already, you know. We got in a cab and we went over to the apartment, on the east side. Charles DeForest was playing there. He's playing piano and singing. I knew he'd be thrilled to meet or see Mercer in the crowd, you know. So we walked in there and, somebody else was playing piano, a substitute pianist, and it was a woman, and Mercer wasn't impressed, and he says, real loud, we were sitting right next to her, is this who you brought me in to hear? And so Charles DeForest saw what was happening, came to the rescue, and he came to the piano, and he said, great, Johnny Mercer's with us in the audience tonight, and I'm going to sing something now that he probably just has forgotten that he's written. It's something that's very seldom heard, and he began to sing something. Mercer got up. He said, that's not my song. That's Leo Robbins' lyric, for God's sake. And he walked out and left me with the bill.
Very nice.
So later on, when he came into Condon's later on that week, I referred to the experience that he had barely remember it. He had a faint recollection of the whole thing. He was great before he started drinking. After that, he was tough to, he couldn't figure him out, really.
Well, actually, I think, you know, stories are pretty legendary of how unpleasant he was when he was drunk.
Yeah, I'm afraid I was witness to that.
Yeah, yeah. But, well, but at least you got to meet him.
Oh, but he was a sweetheart of a guy, really. Yeah, he was wonderful.
We're listening to the Johnny Mercer tribute concert featuring singer Rebecca Kilgore and pianist and songwriter Dave Frischberg, recorded last fall. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the Fresh Air concert recorded last fall featuring singer Rebecca Kilgore and pianist and songwriter Dave Frischberg, performing the music of Johnny Mercer. It's part of our series of memorable Fresh Air shows from 2009.
You know, one of the things Mercer did was write a lot of songs for movies. And let's hear a song that was written by Mercer for a film, written with music by Jerome Kern. The song is I'm Old Fashioned, and it's from the 1942 film You Were Never Lovelier with Fred Astaire and Rita Hayworth.
Right.
Who I think was dubbed.
Yeah.
I don't think she did her own singing.
Nan Nguyen?
Yeah. I've never heard of her, but she's the one who dubbed her, Nan Nguyen.
Well.
So this is singer Becky Kilgore with songwriter, pianist, and singer Dave Frischberg at the piano.
I am not such a clever one about the latest fads, and I'll admit I was never one adored by local lads. Not that I ever tried to be a saint. I'm the type that they classify as quaint. I'm old-fashioned. I love the moonlight. I love the old-fashioned things. The sound of rain upon a window pane, the starry song that April sings. This year's fancies are passing fancies, but sighing sighs holding hands, these my heart understands. I'm old-fashioned, but I don't mind it. That's how I want to be, as long as you agree to stay old-fashioned with me.
That was really lovely. I'm so glad you chose to do that for us in your concert. And performing the concert today, a centenary tribute to lyricist Johnny Mercer, is singer Rebecca Kilgore and pianist, songwriter, and singer Dave Frischberg. I think we have time for one more song in our centenary tribute to lyricist Johnny Mercer with singer Rebecca Kilgore and pianist, singer, and songwriter Dave Frischberg. What song would you like to close with?
Well, a song called Dream, which is the most evocative and irresistible of all.
So who wrote the music for Dream?
Johnny Mercer did himself. This is one of his music and words works.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing. You always think of him as just the lyricist, but he really did write several great melodies, too.
I'll see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's hear Dream.
Dream when you're feeling blue. Dream, that's the thing to do. Just watch the smoke rings rise in the air. You'll find your share of memories there. So dream when the day is through. Dream and they might come true. Things never are as bad as they seem. So dream, dream, dream.
What a sweet way to end, and how fitting to end with a song with music and lyrics by Johnny Mercer. And I regret to say that there's more than 1,000 Johnny Mercer songs we didn't have time for in our concert today. But I'm so grateful for the songs that you did do. Becky Kilgore singing for us today, Dave Frischberg singing as well, and also featured on piano. And Dave is also a great songwriter. We didn't get to hear any of his songs today, but we have played them often on Fresh Air. I appreciate both of you coming to do the concert today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank
you. It was a pleasure.
It was really nice. Felt good to do this.
Rebecca Kilgore and Dave Frischberg recorded in November. Their latest album, Why Fight the Feeling, features songs by Frank Lesser. Our centennial tribute to Johnny Mercer was recorded by Jim Zack with Bill Moss at the NOLA Recording Studios in Manhattan. The post-production work was done by our engineer, Audrey Bentham.
You got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got to spread.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Chi. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a healthy and happy new year.
Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No.